defending himself with his sword, with which he also maimed another of my men, and with the flat side of which he stunned me. But hang, man, will you make an end? Athos, what has become of Athos? In beating his retreat, as I have told you, sir, he found behind him the cellar stairs, and as the door was open, he rushed into it. Once there, he locked the door and barricaded himself within. And as we were sure of finding him there, we let him alone. Yes, said D'Artagnan. It was not thought necessary to kill him, but only to imprison him. Good God! To imprison him, sir? He imprisoned himself, I swear. For first, he had made a pretty severe business of it. One man was killed outright, and two were grievously wounded. The dead man and the two wounded ones were carried off by their companions, and I have never since heard any more of either party. I myself, when I had recovered my senses, went to find the governor, to whom I related everything that had taken place, and of whom I inquired what I was to do with the prisoner. But the governor seemed as if he were entirely ignorant of the matter. He told me that he did not know what I was talking about, that the orders I had received did not come from him, and that if I had the misfortune to tell anyone whatever that he had anything to do with this disturbance, he would have me hung. It appeared that I had made an error, sir, that I had arrested the wrong person, and that he who was to have been arrested had escaped. But Athos! Cried D'Artagnan, who became doubly bold when he found that the authorities disclaimed the affair. What has become of him? As I was in haste to repair the injury I'd inflicted on the prisoner, replied the innkeeper, I hurried to the cellar to liberate him. Oh, sir, he was no longer a man. He was a devil. On proposing his liberation, he declared that it was a snare which was laid for him, and that before he came out he must impose conditions. I told him with great humility, for I did not conceal from myself the awkward position in which I had placed myself by laying hands on one of His Majesty's musketeers, I told him that I was ready to submit to his conditions. First, said he, you must give me back my servant, completely armed. We hastened to obey this order, for you understand, sir, that we were disposed to do everything that your friend wished. Monsieur Grimaud, for he told us his name, although he speaks but little, Monsieur Grimaud was sent down into the cellar, all wounded as he was, and his master, having received him, barricaded the door again and sent us about our business. But after all, cried D'Artagnan, where is he? Where is Athos? In the cellar, sir. What, you rascal? Have you kept him in the cellar all this time? Good heavens, no, sir. We keep him in the cellar? You do not know, then, what he has been at there? Oh, if you could only persuade him to come out, sir, I should be forever grateful to you. I would adore you as my patron saint. Then he is there? I shall find him there? Certainly, sir. He has obstinately persisted in remaining there. Every day we put through the air hole some bread on the point of a pitchfork, and some meat, too, when he asks for it. But alas, it is not of bread and meat that he makes the greatest consumption. I endeavoured once to go down with two of my servants, but he went into a terrible fury. I heard the click of his pistols and of his servant's carbine. Then, when we asked what their intentions were, the master answered that they had between them 40 shots to fire, and that they would fire them all, even to the last, sooner than permit any one of us to put a foot in the cellar. Then, sir, I went and complained to the governor, who told me that I had only got what I deserved, and that this would teach me to insult honourable gentlemen who put up at my house. So that since that time, replied D'Artagnan, who was unable to refrain from laughing at the piteous face of the innkeeper, so that from that time, sir, continued he, we lead the saddest life that can be imagined. For, sir, you must know that all our provisions are in the cellar. Our wine in bottles is there, and our wine in casks. Beer, oil, spices, lard, and sausages. And as we are forbidden to go down, we are obliged to refuse provisions and drink to the travellers who come here, so that we lose custom every day. Should your friend stop in my cellar one more week, we shall be utterly ruined.
And serve you right too, you knave. Could you not plainly see, by our appearance, that we were men of quality and not coiners?
Yes, sir, yes, you're right, said mine host. But hark, hark, he's getting into a passion now.
No doubt somebody has disturbed him, said D'Artagnan.
But he needs must be disturbed, exclaimed the host. Two English gentlemen have just come in.
Well, what then?
Well, the English gentlemen love good wine, as you know, sir, and these gentlemen have called for the best. My wife has, no doubt, asked permission of Monsieur Athos to enter, to satisfy these gentlemen, and he has refused, as usual. Oh, merciful goodness, listen how the row increases!
D'Artagnan did, in fact, hear a great noise proceeding from the cellar. He therefore arose, and preceded by the landlord, who wrung his hands, and followed by Planchet, who carried his carbine ready cocked, he approached the scene of action. The two gentlemen were highly exasperated. They had travelled a long way, and were fainting with hunger and thirst. "But it is positive tyranny," cried they, in very good French, although with a foreign accent, "that this downright madman will not allow these good people the use of their own wine. We will break open the door, and, if he is too furious, we will kill him." "Hold there, gentlemen!" exclaimed D'Artagnan, drawing his pistols from his belt. "You will not kill anyone, if you please!"
"Very good, very good," said the calm voice of Athos from behind the door. "Let these child-eaters enter, and we shall soon see."
Brave as they appeared to be, the two Englishmen looked at one another with some degree of hesitation. One would have said that the cellar contained one of those ravenous ogres, those gigantic heroes of popular legend, whose cavern none could enter with impunity. There was a moment of silence, but at last the two Englishmen were ashamed to retire, and the most impatient of them went down 5 or 6 steps of the staircase and gave the door a kick sufficient to break through a wall.
"Planchet," said D'Artagnan, cocking his pistols, "I will take the one that is up here. You take charge of him who is below." "Ah, gentlemen, you wish for a fight, do you? Well, we will give you one."
"My God!" cried the hollow voice of Athos. "I think I hear D'Artagnan's voice."
"Yes," said D'Artagnan, raising his voice in his turn. "It is I myself, my friend."
"Good," said Athos. "Then we'll handle these door-breakers."
The gentlemen had drawn their swords, but finding themselves caught between two fires, they hesitated again for a moment. As before, however, pride carried the day, and a second kick made the door crash from top to bottom.
"Step aside, D'Artagnan, step aside!" cried Athos. "I'm going to fire!"
"Gentlemen!"
cried D'Artagnan, whose coolness never forsook him.
"Gentlemen, think better of it!
Wait a moment, Athos! You're about to begin a bad business, gentlemen, and will be riddled with shot. Here are I and my servant, who will give you 3 shots. You will receive the same number from the cellar, and then we shall still have our swords, which I and my friend can handle pretty well, I assure you. Let me arrange the affair. You shall have something to drink directly, I give you my word." "If there is any left," growled Athos in a sneering tone.
The innkeeper felt a cold perspiration trickling down his spine.
"What, if there is any left?"
muttered he.
"What the deuce?" replied D'Artagnan. "There must be some left. Surely these two cannot have drunk out the cellar. Gentlemen, return your swords to their scabbards. Well, put your pistols back into your belts. "Willingly."
D'Artagnan set the example. Then, turning to Planchet, he made him a sign to uncock his carbine. The Englishman was satisfied, yet grumbled as they sheathed their swords. D'Artagnan gave them an account of Athos's imprisonment, and, as they were men of honour, they blamed the innkeeper.
"Now, gentlemen," continued he, "return to your chamber, and I answer for it that in 10 minutes you shall have everything you want."
The Englishman bowed and departed.
"Now that I am alone, my dear Athos," said D'Artagnan, "open the door to me, I implore you."
"Directly," said Athos. Then was heard the sound of clashing fagots and groaning beams. These were the counterscarps and bastions of Athos, which the besieged was himself demolishing. In another instant the door moved, and there was seen the pale face of Athos, who, with a rapid glance, surveyed the outworks. D'Artagnan threw himself upon his neck and embraced him tenderly. But when he wished to lead him out of this humid habitation, he perceived that Athos staggered.
"You are wounded?" exclaimed he.
"Me? Not the least in the world. I am dead drunk, that's all. And never did man do more to become so. Vive Dieu! Landlord, I must have drunk, for my own share, at least 150 bottles."
"Gracious heavens!" exclaimed the landlord. "If the servant has drunk only half as much as the master, I am ruined."
"Grimaud is too well behaved a servant," said Athos, "to allow himself to live in the same manner as his master. He has, therefore, only drunk out of the cask. Hark, I verily believe that he has forgotten to put the spigot in. Do you hear? It is running."
D'Artagnan broke out into a roar of laughter, which changed the landlord's shivers into a raging fever. At the same time Grimaud made his appearance behind his master with his carbine on his shoulder, and his head shaking like the drunken satyr in Rubens's pictures. He was soaked, both before and behind, with an unctuous liquid, which the landlord recognized as his best olive oil. The little company crossed the large room and installed itself in the best apartment of the inn, of which D'Artagnan took possession authoritatively. In the meantime, the landlord and his wife hastened with lamps into the cellar, from which they had been so long excluded, and where a frightful spectacle awaited them. Beyond the fortifications in which Athos had made a breach to get out, and which were composed of fagots, planks, and empty casks, arranged according to the rules of strategic art, they saw here and there, floating amidst pools of oil and wine, the bones of all the hams that had been eaten, whilst a heap of broken bottles covered all the left-hand corner of the cellar, and a barrel, of which the tap had been left open, was losing through that opening the last drops of its blood. The image of devastation and death, as the poet of antiquity says, reigned there as on a battlefield. Of 50 sausages which had hung on the beams, scarcely 10 remained. The howlings of the landlord and his wife pierced through the vaulted ceiling of the cellar. D'Artagnan himself was affected by them, yet Athos did not even turn his head. But rage succeeded grief. The innkeeper armed himself with a spit and rushed, in a paroxysm of despair, into the room where the two friends were sitting.
"Some wine!" cried Athos, on seeing the landlord.
"Some wine!" exclaimed the astonished host. "Some wine! Why, you have drunk more than 100 pistoles' worth, and I am a ruined man! Ruined! Lost! Annihilated!"
"Bah!" said Athos. "We were constantly thirsty."
"But even if you had been contented with drinking! But you have broken all the bottles!"
"Why, you pushed me on a heap which rolled over. It was all your fault."
"All my oil is lost!"
"Oil is a sovereign balm for wounds, and it was necessary that poor Grimaud should bathe those you had inflicted."
"All my sausages are chewed away!"
"There is an enormous number of rats in that cellar."
"You shall pay me for all this!"
cried the exasperated landlord.
"Thrice-doomed knave!" exclaimed Athos.
But he fell back immediately. He had exhausted all his strength. D'Artagnan hastened to shield him by raising his riding whip. The host recoiled a step and burst into tears.
"That will teach you," said D'Artagnan, "to behave with a little more politeness to the guests whom God sends you."
"God? Say the devil!"
"My dear friend," said D'Artagnan, "if you assail our ears in this way again, we will all four go and shut ourselves in your cellar and see whether the destruction is as great as you pretend."
"Well then, gentlemen," said the landlord, "I am wrong, I confess. But mercy is due to every sinner. You are noblemen, and I am only a poor innkeeper. You will have mercy on me."
"Ah, if you talk in that manner," said Athos, "you will pierce my heart, and the tears will flow from my eyes, as the wine ran from your casks. I am not so great a devil as I look. Come, come here, and let us talk it over." The host approached, with some hesitation. "Come here, I tell you, and do not be afraid," continued Athos. "At the moment I was about to pay you, I laid my purse upon the table."
"Yes, my lord."
"And that purse contained 60 pistoles. Where is it?"
"Lodged at the register office, my lord. It was said to be false money."
"Well, then, recover my purse and keep the 60 pistoles.
"But your lordship well knows that the register office never gives up what it has once got. If it was bad money, there might be some hope, but unfortunately, it is all good coin."
"Let us see," said D'Artagnan. "Where is Athos's old horse?"
"In the stables."
"How much is he worth?"
50 pistoles at the most."
"He is worth 80. Take him and say no more about it." "What? Do you mean to sell my horse?" said Athos. "My Bajazet? And on what shall I make the campaign? On Grimaud's?" "I have brought you another," said D'Artagnan.
"And a magnificent one," cried the landlord.
"Then," said Athos, "if there be another, younger and handsomer, take the old one. And now let us have something to drink."
"Of what sort?"
said mine host, completely pacified. "Of that which is at the bottom, near the laths. There are 25 bottles of it remaining. The others were broken by my fall. Bring up 6.
"This man is a perfect tun," said the landlord to himself. "If he should only remain here a fortnight and pay for what he drinks, I should re-establish my affairs."
"Now," said Athos, "whilst we are waiting for the wine, tell me what has become of the others. Come, let me hear."
D'Artagnan recounted how he had found Porthos in bed with a sprain, and Aramis between 2 theologians. As he ended his narration, the landlord entered with the bottles which had been ordered, and a ham which had been, fortunately, left outside the cellar.
"That's right," said Athos, filling his own glass and that of D'Artagnan. "Here's to Porthos and Aramis. But, my friend, what is the matter with you? And what has happened to you yourself? I fancy that you are looking sad."
"Alas," replied D'Artagnan, "I am the most unhappy of you all."
"You unhappy, D'Artagnan?" said Athos. "Let me hear how you can be unhappy. Tell me that."
"By and by," said D'Artagnan.
"By and by? And why by and by? Is it because you think that I am drunk, D'Artagnan? Just understand, then, that my ideas are never clearer than when I am in my cups. Speak, therefore. I am all attention."
D'Artagnan related his adventure with Madame Bonancieux. Athos heard him without even moving his eyebrow. Then, when he had ended,
"Those are all trifles," said Athos.
"Trifles." This was the favorite word of Athos.
"You repeat the word trifles, my dear Athos," said D'Artagnan, "and it comes with a bad grace from you who have never loved."
The dull eye of Athos lighted up suddenly, though it was but a momentary flash, and then it again became dull and wandering as before.
"It is true," he said quietly. I have never loved.
You see, then, stony heart, said D'Artagnan, that you are wrong to be so hard on us who have more tender natures.
Tender natures, wounded hearts, exclaimed Athos.
What are you saying?
I say that love is a lottery in which he who wins gains death. You are very fortunate to have lost, believe me, my dear D'Artagnan. And if I have any advice to give you, it is to lose always.
She seemed to love me so much.
Of course she seemed.
Oh, she loved me!
Child, there is not a man who has not, like you, believed that his mistress loved him. And there is not a man who has not been deceived by his mistress. Except you, Athos, who never had one.
It is true, said Athos, after a moment's silence. I never had one. Let us drink.
But then, said D'Artagnan, philosopher as you are, instruct and console me. I want instruction and consolation.
Consolation? About what?
About my misfortune.
Your misfortune makes me laugh, said Athos, shrugging his shoulders. I should be curious to know what you would say if I were to tell you a love story.
About yourself?
Or one of my friends? What does it signify?
Tell it me, Athos, tell it!
Let us drink. That will be far better.
Drink and tell your story!
Yes, I can do that, said Athos, emptying and again filling his glass. The two things accompany one another admirably well.
I am attentive, said D'Artagnan.
Athos collected himself, and as he did so, D'Artagnan saw him grow more pale. He was at that point of intoxication at which vulgar tipplers fall down and sleep. As for him, he actually dreamed aloud without sleeping. There was something awful in this somnambulism of intoxication.
"You absolutely wish it," said he.
"I even entreat you," replied D'Artagnan.
"Well, then, it shall be as you desire. One of my friends, you understand, not myself," said Athos, interrupting himself with a somber smile. "One of the counts of my province, that is to say of Berry, as noble as a Dandolo or a Montmorency, became enamoured at 25 years of age of a young girl of 16 who was as beautiful as love. Through the simplicity of her age, an ardent soul was perceptible, the soul not of a woman, but of a poet. She did not merely please, she intoxicated the mind. Her home was in a small village where she lived with her brother, who was a curate. They were newcomers into that part of the country. No one knew whence they came, and on seeing her so beautiful and her brother so pious, no one thought of inquiring. They were, moreover, said to belong to a good family. My friend, who was the great man of that neighbourhood, might have seduced her, or even seized upon her by force if he had chosen. He was the master, and who would have thought of defending two unknown strangers? Unfortunately, he was a man of honour, and he married her. The fool, the ass, the idiot!
But why so, since he loved her? Said D'Artagnan.
Wait a little, replied Athos. He took her to his castle and made her the first lady of the province. And, to do her justice, she filled her position admirably.
Well, said D'Artagnan.
Well, one day when she was out hunting with her husband, continued Athos in a low voice and speaking very quickly, she fell from her horse and fainted. The count hastened to her assistance, and as she seemed half suffocated by her clothes, cut them with his dagger so that her shoulder was exposed.
Guess what there was upon her shoulder, D'Artagnan, said Athos, with a convulsive burst of laughter.
How can I tell? Demanded D'Artagnan.
A fleur-de-lis, said Athos. She was branded.
and at one draught he emptied the glass which was in his hand.
"Horrible! What are you telling me?" cried D'Artagnan.
"The truth, my dear fellow. The angel was a fiend. The simple young girl had been a thief."
"And what did the Count do?"
"The Count was a powerful noble. He had the undisputed right of executing justice on his domain. He tore off the remainder of her clothes, tied her hands behind her back, and hung her on a tree."
"Oh, heavens, Athos! A murder!" cried D'Artagnan.
"Yes, a murder. Nothing else," said Athos, pale as death. "But they leave me without wine, it seems." And he seized the last bottle by its neck, put it to his mouth, and emptied it at a draught, as though it had been a glass. His head then fell on his two hands, whilst D'Artagnan remained before him, overwhelmed with horror. "That has cured me of women. Beautiful, poetic, and fascinating women," said Athos, raising himself and forgetting to preserve the mystery of an intervening count. "May God grant as much to you. Let us drink."
"And so she's dead?" stammered D'Artagnan.
"Egad," said Athos. "Hold your glass. Will you have some ham, you rogue? We cannot drink any more."
"But her brother?" timidly added D'Artagnan.
"Her brother?" replied Athos.
"Yes, the priest."
"Ah, I sought him to hang him also, but he was too quick for me. He had fled the evening before."
"And did anyone ever discover who the wretch was?"
"It was the first lover and accomplice of the girl. A fine fellow who had pretended to be a curate, that he might get his mistress married and provided for. He must have got quartered, I trust."
"Oh, my God! My God!" exclaimed D'Artagnan, astounded by this horrible adventure.
"Eat some of this ham, D'Artagnan. It is exquisite," said Athos, cutting a slice, which he put upon the young man's plate. "What a misfortune that there were not four such hams in the cellar. I should have drunk 50 bottles more."
D'Artagnan could no longer bear this conversation. It would have driven him mad. He let his head fall upon his hands and pretended to sleep.
"The young men nowadays do not know how to stand their drink," said Athos, looking at him with pity. "And yet that is one of the best of them."
28. The Return. D'Artagnan had not recovered from the consternation produced by the terrible communication of Athos. Many things yet appeared to him obscure in this semi-confession. In the first place, it had been made by a man who was quite drunk, to another man who was half drunk. And yet, in spite of that confusion of the brain which is produced by two or three bottles of Burgundy, D'Artagnan, on awakening the next morning, had each of Athos's words as thoroughly present in his mind as though they had been stamped upon it as they fell from his companion's lips. His doubts made him only the more eager to arrive at certainty, and he went to his friend's room with a determination to renew the conversation. But he found Athos quite himself again, that is to say, the acutest and most impenetrable of men. Moreover, the musketeer, after he had exchanged a smile and shaken hands with him, anticipated his thought.
"I was very tipsy last night, my dear D'Artagnan," said he. "I perceived it this morning by my tongue, which was still heavy, and my pulse, which was still agitated. I would bet that I uttered 1,000 extravagances."
And as he said this, he looked at his friend with an earnestness which embarrassed him.
"No," said D'Artagnan. "If I remember right, you said nothing out of the common."
"Ah, you astonish me. I thought that I had related some most lamentable story."
And he looked at the young man as if he would have read the very depths of his heart.
"Faith," replied D'Artagnan, "it appears that I was even more tipsy than you were, since I remember nothing."
Athos was not satisfied with this, and continued, "You cannot fail to have observed, my dear friend,
that each one has his own kind of drunkenness, sad or gay. Mine is of a melancholy sort, and when once I am tipsy, my mania is to narrate all the lugubrious tales with which my foolish nurse has filled my brain. It is my failing, a great fault, I confess, but barring that, I am an excellent drinker." Athos said this in such a natural manner that D'Artagnan was shaken in his conviction. "Ah, then, that is it," said the young man, as if endeavouring to recall the truth. "That is it. I remember, as one recollects a dream, that we talked of people being hung." "Ah, you see," said Athos, growing pale but attempting to smile. "I was sure of it. People being hanged is quite my nightmare."
"Yes, yes," replied D'Artagnan. "And this is what I can recall to mind. Yes, it was so. Listen, then. It was something about a woman."
"See there," replied Athos, becoming almost livid. "It is my best story, the one of the woman with fair hair, and when I tell that, I am sure to be dead drunk."
"Yes, that is it," said D'Artagnan. "A story about a fair woman, tall and beautiful, with blue eyes."
"Yes, who was hanged?"
"By her husband, who was a nobleman of your acquaintance," said D'Artagnan, looking earnestly at Athos.
"Well, now, see how a man might be compromised, when one no longer knows what he is saying," replied Athos, shrugging his shoulders, as if he pitied himself. "Positively, I will not get tipsy any more, D'Artagnan. It is a very bad habit." D'Artagnan continued silent, and then, suddenly changing the conversation, Athos said, "Apropos, I thank you for the horse you have brought me."
"Do you like him?"
"Yes, but he would not stand work."
"You are mistaken. I went 10 leagues with him in less than an hour and a half, and he appeared as if he had only gone round the Place Saint-Sulpice."
"Ah, then, you make me regret him."
"Regret him?"
"Yes, for I have parted with him."
"How's that?"
"The fact is, this morning I got up at 6. You were sleeping like a deaf man, and I did not know what to do, being still quite stupefied by last night's debauch. I therefore went down to the common room and saw one of the Englishmen, who was buying a horse of a cooper, his own having died the day before. I approached him, and, as I saw he was offering 100 pistoles for a sorrel horse, 'Egad, sir,' said I, 'I have also a horse to sell.' 'And a very handsome one, too,' said he. 'I saw him yesterday. Your friend's servant was holding him.' 'Do you think he is worth 100 pistoles? "Yes. Will you sell him to me at that price?' 'No. But I will play you for him.' 'At what?' 'At dice.' 'No sooner said than done, and I lost the horse.' 'Ah, but after all,' continued Athos, 'I won back his caparison.'" D'Artagnan made a wry face. "Does that annoy you?" asked Athos.
"Yes, indeed, I confess it does," replied D'Artagnan. "That horse ought to have led to our recognition on a battlefield. It was a pledge, a souvenir. Athos, you have done wrong."
"But, my dear fellow, put yourself in my place," replied the musketeer. "I was horribly tired of myself, and then, upon my honour, I do not like English horses. Besides, if it is of any consequence that we should be recognised by anyone, the saddle will do well enough for that, for it is very remarkable. As for the horse, we will find some excuse as a reason for its disappearance. What the plague! A horse is mortal. Let us say that mine has had the glanders or the farcy." But D'Artagnan did not laugh. "I am sorry for this," continued Athos, "since you seem to set such a value on these animals, for I have not yet finished my tale."
"Why? What more have you done?"
"After having lost my horse, 9 against 10, for that was the throw, the idea came into my head to stake yours."
"But you confined yourself to the mere idea, I hope?"
"No, I put it into execution instantaneously."
"Ah, was ever such a thing heard of? exclaimed D'Artagnan anxiously. "I staked him, and lost."
"My horse?"
"Yes, your horse. 7-8, for I lost only by 1 point. You know the old proverb."
"Athos, you have lost your senses, I swear!"
"My dear fellow, it was yesterday when I was telling you those foolish stories that you should have said that and not this morning. I lost him, however, with all his ornaments in comparison."
"But this is quite frightful!"
"Listen now. You have not heard the end of it yet. I should be a most excellent player if I did not get so infatuated. But I do get infatuated, just as I am when I drink. Well, accordingly, I obstinately persevered at the game."
"But what more could you stake? You had nothing left."
"Yes, yes, my friend. There remained that diamond which now glitters on your finger, and which I had noticed yesterday."
"This diamond!" exclaimed D'Artagnan, putting his hand quickly on the ring.
"And as I am a judge of these things, having had some few of my own, I valued it at 1,000 pistoles.
"I hope," said D'Artagnan very seriously, whilst he was half dead with alarm, "that you did not make any mention of my diamond."
"On the contrary, my dear friend, do you not see that this diamond became our last resource? I might, with that, win back our horses and their accoutrements, and, perhaps, money enough for our journey."
"Athos, you make me tremble!" cried D'Artagnan.
"So I mentioned your diamond to my adversary, who had also remarked it. What the plague, my dear fellow! Would you carry a star of heaven on your finger and wish no one to observe it? Impossible!"
"Go on, my dear fellow, go on," said D'Artagnan. "For upon my honour you horrify me with your calmness."
"We divided the diamond into 10 parts, of 100 pistoles each."
"Oh, you are joking on purpose to try me,"
said D'Artagnan, whom anger began to catch by the hair, as Minerva caught Achilles in the Iliad. "No, I am not joking, by heaven. I should like to have seen you in the same situation. For a whole fortnight I had not looked upon a human face, and had been brutalizing myself in there by parleying only with bottles."
"That was no reason why you should stake my diamond," said D'Artagnan, closing his hand with a nervous contraction.
"Listen, then, to the end. 10 parts of 100 pistoles each would be 10 throws without revenge. In 13 throws I lost all. In 13 throws. The number 13 has always been fatal to me. It was the 13th of July when—"
"Zounds!"
cried D'Artagnan, arising from the table, the morning's narrative making him forget that of the night before.
"Patience!" cried Athos.
"I had formed a plan. The Englishman was an original. I had seen him in the morning talking to Grimaud, and Grimaud had informed me that he had made proposals to engage him in his service. I staked Grimaud, the silent Grimaud, divided into 10 portions.
"Ha! Well, was ever such a thing heard of?"
said D'Artagnan, bursting out into a laugh. "Grimaud himself, do you understand? And by these 10 parts of Grimaud, who is not worth a ducat when entire, I won back the diamond. Tell me now if perseverance is not a virtue."
"Faith, it is all very droll,"
said the now comforted D'Artagnan, holding his sides with laughter. "So, you understand, finding myself in the right vein, I began anew upon the diamond."
"Ah, the deuce!"
said D'Artagnan, becoming again overclouded. "I won back your trappings, then your horse, then my own trappings, then my own horse, and then lost them all again. In short, I ended by recovering your trappings and mine, and that is how we now stand. It was a superb throw, and therefore I left off." D'Artagnan sighed as if the weight of the hotel had been taken off his breast.
"After all, my diamond is safe," he said timidly.
"Untouched, my dear friend, besides the trappings of your Bucephalus and mine.
But what shall we do with our saddles without horses? I have an idea as to them. Athos, you make me tremble.
Listen, D'Artagnan. You have not played for a long time,
and I have no desire to play.
Well, don't make a vow about it. You have not played for a long time. I should say, therefore, that you ought to be in luck.
Well, and what then?
Well, the Englishman and his companion are still here. I observed that they regretted the trappings. You seem to value your horse, and, in your place, I would stake my trappings against my horse.
But he would not wish for one set of trappings.
Stake the two. Egad, I am not an egotist like you.
You would you?
Said D'Artagnan, hesitating, for the confidence of Athos began to influence him unconsciously.
Upon my honour, I would, on one throw.
But having lost the horses, I should very much like to keep the trappings at least.
Then stake your diamond.
Oh, that is quite another thing. Never, never.
The devil!
I would propose to you to stake Planchet. But as that game has been tried once, the Englishman would not perhaps wish to try it again.
Decidedly, my dear Athos, said D'Artagnan, I would prefer risking nothing.
It is a pity, said Athos coldly. The Englishman is well lined with pistoles.
Egad, do try one throw. A throw is soon made.
And if I lose,
you will gain.
But if I lose,
well, then you will surrender the trappings.
Well, here goes for one throw, said D'Artagnan.
Athos went to look for the Englishman, and found him in the stables, where he was looking wistfully at the saddles. The opportunity was good. He made his conditions, the two sets of trappings against one horse or 100 pistoles at choice. The Englishman calculated quickly. The two sets of trappings were well worth 300 pistoles, so he agreed. D'Artagnan trembled as he threw the dice, and only turned up the number 3. His paleness quite frightened Athos, who contented himself with saying,
"That's a bad throw, comrade. You will have the horses all caparisoned, sir."
The triumphant Englishman did not give himself the trouble even to shake the dice, and so sure was he of winning that he threw the ivory on the table without looking. D'Artagnan turned away to hide his ill humour.
"Well, well, well," said Athos, in his usual calm voice. "This is a most extraordinary throw, and I have only seen it 4 times in my life. 2 aces."
The Englishman looked, and was seized with astonishment. D'Artagnan looked, and coloured with joy.
"Yes," continued Athos, "only 4 times. Once at Monsieur de Crequis's, once at my own house in the country, in my castle of... when I had a castle, a 3rd time at Monsieur de Treville's, where it astonished us all, and a 4th time at a wine shop, where it fell to me, and I lost by it 100 louis and a supper."
"Will the gentleman take back his horse?" said the Englishman.
"Certainly," said D'Artagnan.
"Then there is no revenge."
"Our conditions were no revenge. Do you remember?"
"True. The horse shall be delivered to your servant, sir."
"One moment," said Athos. "With your permission, sir, I desire to speak a private word with my friend."
"Speak."
Athos led D'Artagnan apart.
"Well," said D'Artagnan, "what do you want with me now, tempter? You want me to play, do you not?"
"No. I want you to reflect."
"On what?"
"You are going to take back the horse?"
"Certainly."
"You are wrong. I would take the 100 pistoles. You know that you staked the trappings against the horse or 100 pistoles at your choice."
"Yes."
"I would take the 100 pistoles."
"Would you? But I shall take the horse."
"And you are wrong, I say again. What shall we do with one horse between us two? I cannot get up behind you. We shall have the appearance of the 2 sons of Amon who lost their brothers. And you would not mortify me by prancing about on this magnificent steed close by my side."
"I would take the 100 pistoles without a moment's hesitation. We want money to return to Paris." "'I really have such a fancy for this horse, Athos.'
"'And you are wrong, my friend. "'A horse shies. "'A horse stumbles and breaks his knees. "'A horse eats at a rack where a glandered horse has eaten just before. "'And thus you lose a horse, or rather 100 pistoles. "'Then it is necessary for the master to feed his horse, "'when, on the contrary, 100 pistoles feed the master. "'But how shall we return?'
"'On our servants' horses, to be sure. "'It will be evident enough from our appearance "'that we are people of consequence.
"'A nice figure we shall cut on those hacks "'whilst Aramis and Porthos are dashing about on their chargers.
"'Aramis! Porthos!' exclaimed Athos, "'and he began to laugh heartily.
"'What now?' demanded D'Artagnan, "'who did not understand the cause of his friend's merriment.
"'Nothing, nothing.' "'Go on,' said Athos. "'And your advice is to take the 100 pistoles, D'Artagnan. "'With them we can feast till the end of the month. "'We have suffered much from fatigue, you know, "'and it will be well for us to repose ourselves for a time.
"'I repose myself? "'Oh, no, Athos. "'Immediately on my return to Paris "'I shall set out in search of that poor woman.
"'Well, do you think your horse will be as useful to you "'for that purpose as the gold?'
"'Take the 100 pistoles, my friend. Take the 100 pistoles.'
D'Artagnan only wanted a good reason for giving up, and this appeared to him an excellent one. Besides, by resisting any longer, he feared that he should appear selfish. He therefore chose the 100 pistoles, which the Englishman immediately paid him. Their only thought, then, was to set out. The peace which they had finally sealed with the landlord cost 6 pistoles, in addition to Athos's old horse. D'Artagnan and Athos took the horses of Planchet and Grimaud, and the two valets took to the road on foot, carrying the saddles on their heads. Badly mounted as the two friends were, they soon left their servants behind them and arrived at Crèvecœur. At a distance they saw Aramis leaning sorrowfully from the window and, like Sister Anne, looking at the dust on the horizon.
"'Hullo! Hey, Aramis!' shouted out the two friends. "'What the plague are you doing there?'
"'Ah, is it you, Athos? Is it you, D'Artagnan?' said the young man. "'I was just thinking how rapidly the things of this world disappear.' My English horse, which was getting more and more distant, and has just disappeared amidst a cloud of dust, was to me a living image of the mutability of terrestrial things. Life itself may be resolved into 3 words, erat, est, fuit.
And all this really means, inquired D'Artagnan, who began to suspect the truth.
It means that I have just been taken in a bargain. And sold for 60 louis, a horse which, by the manner in which he moves, should be able to trot 5 leagues an hour.
D'Artagnan and Athos burst out into a laugh.
My dear D'Artagnan, said Aramis, do not be too much displeased with me, I entreat you. Necessity knows no law. Besides, I am the person punished, since this infamous horse-dealer has cheated me out of 50 louis at least. Ah, you are thrifty managers. You come on your servants' horses and make them lead your charges slowly and by short stages.
At this moment a wagon, which for some minutes had been seen coming along the Amiens road, stopped and out got Planchet and Grimaud with their saddles on their heads. The wagon was going empty to Paris, and the two servants had engaged, as the price of their places, to keep the wagoner in drink throughout the journey.
"'What does this mean?' said Aramis, as he saw them. "'Nothing but the saddles?'
"'Do you understand now?' said Athos.
"'My friends, it is exactly like me. "'I, too, have kept the trappings by instinct.
"'Hello, Bazin. "'Lay my trappings alongside of those belonging to these gentlemen.'
"'And what have you done with your doctors?' demanded D'Artagnan.
"'I invited them to dinner the next day, my dear fellow.' said Aramis. There is some exquisite wine here, by the by, and I made them both as drunk as I could. Then the curate forbade me to abandon the coat, and the Jesuit entreated me to get him enrolled as a musketeer.
"Without any thesis," cried D'Artagnan. "Without thesis! I demand, for my part, the suppression of the thesis!"
"Since that time I have lived very agreeably. I have begun a poem in one-syllable verse. It is rather difficult, but merit of every kind consists in conquering difficulty. It is gallant in character, and I will read to you the first canto. There are 400 lines, and they only occupy a minute."
"Faith," said D'Artagnan, who detested verses almost as much as he did Latin, "add to the merit of the difficulty that of brevity, and you are at least sure that your poem will have two merits."
"Besides," continued Aramis, "it is pervaded by a virtuous passion." "Well, my friends," added he, "and so we return to Paris. Bravo, I am ready, and we shall fall in with the simple Porthos once more. So much the better. You could not believe how I have missed that great ninny. I like to see him so self-complacent. It reconciles me to myself. Catch him selling his horse, even for a kingdom. I would I could see him on his horse and in his saddle. He will have, I am sure, the look of the great mogul." After they had halted an hour to rest their horses, Aramis paid his bill, placed Bazin in the wagon with his companions, and they then set out to rejoin Porthos. They found him almost entirely cured, and consequently less pale than when D'Artagnan saw him at his first visit. He was seated at a table on which, although he was alone, there was displayed a dinner for four persons. This dinner consisted of viands admirably dressed, of choice wines and splendid fruit.
"Mon Dieu!" said he, rising. "You have come in the nick of time! I was just at the soup, and you will dine with me!"
"Oh! Oh!" said D'Artagnan. "It is not Mousqueton who has lassoed such bottles as these. Besides, here is a larded fricandeau and a fillet of beef."
"I am recruiting my strength," said Porthos. "I am recruiting my strength. Nothing weakens one so much as these devilish sprains. Have you ever had any sprains, Athos?"
"Never," said Athos. "Only I remember that in our skirmish in the Rue de Ferou I received a sword thrust, which, at the end of 15 or 20 days, produced exactly the same consequences as a sprain."
"But this dinner was not for yourself alone, my dear Porthos," said Aramis.
"No," said Porthos. "I expected some gentlemen from the neighbourhood, who have just sent word that they cannot come. But as you will take their places, I shall lose nothing by the exchange. Hallo, Mousqueton, bring chairs and let the bottles be doubled."
"Do you know what we are eating here?" asked Athos, after 10 minutes had elapsed.
"Egad," replied D'Artagnan, "I am eating veal larded with marrow."
"And I, veal cutlets," said Porthos.
"And I, capon," said Aramis.
"You are all mistaken, gentlemen," gravely replied Athos. "You are eating horse."
"Come, come," said D'Artagnan.
"The horse?" cried Aramis, making a horrible face. Porthos alone was silent.
"Yes, the horse. Is it not so, Porthos? Are we not eating the horse, and perhaps the saddle with it?"
"No, gentlemen, I have kept the caparison."
"Faith, we are all bad alike," said Aramis. "One would say that we had done it by agreement."
"What would you have?" said Porthos. "The horse shamed my visitors, and I did not wish to humiliate them."
"Then your duchess is still at the baths, is she not?" inquired D'Artagnan.
"Yes," replied Porthos. "Then the governor of the province, one of the gentlemen I expected here today, appeared to wish so much for him that I gave him to him."
"Gave him?" exclaimed D'Artagnan.
"Oh, yes, zounds, yes, that is the expression," said Porthos, "for he was certainly worth 150 louis, and the rascal would only pay me 80.
"Without the saddle?" said Aramis.
"Yes, without the saddle."
"You observe, gentlemen," said Athos, "that, after all, Porthos has made the best bargain of any of us."
There was then a perfect shout of laughter, at which poor Porthos was altogether astonished. But they soon explained to him the reason of this mirth, in which, as usual, he participated noisily.
"So we are all in cash now," said D'Artagnan.
"Not I, for one," said Athos. "I found Aramis's Spanish wine so good that I sent 60 bottles in the wagon with the servants, which has very much impoverished me."
"And I," said Aramis, "had given almost my last sou to the Church of Montdidier and the Jesuits of Amiel. And I had, besides, made engagements which I was compelled to keep. Masses ordered for myself and for you, gentlemen, which will surely be said, and by which I do not doubt we shall be greatly benefited."
"And do you believe that my sprain has cost me nothing?" said Porthos, "not to mention Mousqueton's wound, for which I was obliged to have a surgeon in attendance upon him twice a day."
"Well, well, I see," said Athos, exchanging a smile with Aramis and D'Artagnan, "that you have behaved nobly towards the poor lad. It is like a good master."
"In short," said Porthos, "when my bill is paid, I shall have about 30 crowns remaining."
"And I about 10 pistoles, said Aramis.
"It appears," said Athos, "that we are the Croesuses of the party. How much remains of your 100 pistoles, D'Artagnan?"
"Of my 100 pistoles? In the first place, I gave you 50.
"Did you really?"
"Most assuredly."
"Ah, it is true, I recollect it."
"Then I paid the landlord 6.
"What an animal that landlord was!
Why did you give him 6 pistoles?
"It was you who told me to give them to him."
"It is true. In fact, I am too generous."
"And the balance?"
25 louis. said D'Artagnan.
"And I," said Athos, pulling out a few small coins from his pocket, "see what I've got."
"You, nothing."
"Faith, just so. Or at any rate, so little as to be not worth adding to the general store.
Now let us reckon up how much we have got. Porthos, 30 crowns. Aramis,
10 pistoles.
And you, D'Artagnan?"
25.
"That makes in all," said Athos.
475 livres, said D'Artagnan, who calculated like Archimedes.
"When we reach Paris, we shall have 400, said Porthos, "besides the horse trappings."
"But our regimental mounts," said Aramis.
"Well, the 4 horses of our servants will procure 2 fit for their masters, which we must draw lots for. With the 400 livres, we can get 1/2 horse for one of the dismounted ones. And then we will give the dregs of our pockets to D'Artagnan, who is in luck, and he shall go and stake them at the 1st tennis court we come to. There now!" "Let us dine," said Porthos, "for the 2nd course is getting cold."
And the 4 friends, now more at ease concerning the future, did honour to the repast, of which the remnants were abandoned to Mousqueton, Bazin, Planchet, and Grimaud. On arriving in Paris, D'Artagnan found a note from Monsieur des Essarts, announcing that, as His Majesty had determined on opening the campaign on the 1st of May, he must immediately make ready his equipments. He ran at once to his friends, whom he had only quitted 30 minutes before, and whom he found very melancholy, or rather very anxious. They were in grand consultation at Athos's, which always indicated a concern of some importance. They had, in fact, each received a similar note from Monsieur de Tréville. The 4 philosophers looked at one another in great amazement. Monsieur de Tréville never jested on a matter of discipline.
"And at what sum do you estimate these equipments?" asked D'Artagnan.
"Oh, one cannot say," replied Aramis. "We have just made our calculations with a Spartan economy, and 1,500 livres will be absolutely necessary for each."
4 times 15 makes 60. That is 6,000 livres, said Athos.
"For my part," said D'Artagnan, "I think that 1,000 livres would be sufficient for each. It is true that I speak not as a Spartan, but as an attorney."
This word, attorney, awoke Porthos.
"Stop! I have an idea," said he.